All right. It is Tuesday, the 12th of March, cliffcentral.com and The Real Network. We're doing a little transition as we go into something new, but Democracy 101 is here this morning, which of course is brought to you by the podcast party.
Yes,
if you're confused
sir.
About any of this, go along to the website and you'll see all of the different things that we're doing in the run-up to these elections. Jack Motlanthe is my co-host here this morning. We've been talking to some very interesting people over the last few weeks, people who are intimately involved with making sure that our election is free and fair. We've been talking to people who are commentators from various backgrounds about research that they've done with respect to where they think the election's going to go. People like Ray Hartley, who we had on not so long ago, published his Brenthurst research just this week, and Franz Cronier just a couple of weeks ago, who said some very interesting things. The big, I suppose you could call it wild card, is Jacob Zuma's MK party. Because that's the part that no one had foreseen. That's the part that I think is going to create some very interesting destabilizing and variant factors around what could happen in the upcoming election. So we'll talk about that a little bit, but I think two of the big stories this week that everyone's talking about. First one, and we'll get to speak to Lukona in just a moment or two, but this is a big story. It's about the IEC identifying an individual believed to have leaked the ANC and Umkhonto weSizwe party candidate lists using the commission's internal systems. So apparently, two lists started circulating on social media on Friday already. I only saw them on Saturday. But they were circulated hours after they were submitted by the parties. The IEC said its preliminary investigation shows that the documents were generated from a workstation in its headquarters before they were deleted. Very suspicious. So someone who works there found these things online,
right,
and decided they were going to print them or send them to someone else. And from there, the wildfire spread.
But I still don't get what the train smash is, because
I don't know.
They were going to release them anyway.
So, why is it a big deal?
Why?
And the party themselves put the lists together. So it's not like someone else put your party list together.
No.
So who are you worried about upsetting with these lists?
I mean, I don't get it.
Like, what's the problem?
Why was it cloaked in secrecy to begin with?
Have you seen the lists?
I've seen a couple. I've seen a couple of them.
Any comments?
And I saw a bunch of names that I didn't recognize on all of these lists. What I found a little interesting was the fact that Jacob Zuma sits at number one on the MK list.
Even though he cannot technically run as a candidate.
Yeah. So it's like,
so he's number one on the list.
What are we doing?
But he won't be president. If the MK party suddenly got enough votes to be the number one party in the country, they got the majority. Let's just say they got more than everyone else, because that's all you need now.
Yeah.
You know, they're all going to be messing around 30, 40% if they're lucky.
Yeah.
20, 30% if they're less lucky. The number one party will be able to decide who the president is. Now, if it's the MK party, it can't be Jacob Zuma, because he's actually barred from being a candidate. So I didn't see who number two was, but I wouldn't have recognized number two if they jumped out of my Rice Krispies this
same
morning.
Yeah. Yep.
Right?
And I will say this. Jacob Zuma has proven to be somewhat of a political shapeshifter, if I can put it that way, because he somehow always finds to, like, he puts himself in really advantageous situations a lot of the time because
he's
of how
an opportunist.
Yeah, because of how he moves.
Definitely.
So let's just say MK wins a sizable number of votes. I think he's going to be the chess player he's always been, and move around the pieces to ultimately benefit him and his maybe 10 loyal supporters within the MK. But I think what will be interesting is if the EFF and the MK somehow work together as a coalition.
That's probably what will happen.
Because from, you know, all the political analysts and all the people that are a lot more educated on the subject than I am, it is pretty clear that KZN is no longer going to be an ANC province.
Yeah, which is also, not by a long shot. I mean, that's going to be the first time in a long time.
Very long time. And, you know, because of the leadership vacuum that is in the in KZN, you know what I mean? The king is not a person that is held in pretty high regard by the people in that province. Sure. So, you know, Jacob Zuma could potentially walk in there and, you know,
it's a kingmaker.
Yeah.
Sure.
And the Cape independence was a stupid idea, but who knows? KZN could be the province that could actually somewhat get it done.
It's amazing. The MK party have also said, if we're not on the ballot, we will prevent the election from taking place.
Yeah.
That's a direct threat to election integrity.
Indian gentleman who's been... What's his name?
Loud and he's got a lot to say.
That guy. I forgot his name.
Don't ask me.
Forgot his name. And he was like, if the MK is not done, he's like, my guy, I need you to sit down because...
Listen, since we're talking democracy, I've just got to bring up Haiti quickly because I'm not sure if you've seen what's been happening in Haiti. It is an absolute disaster, and not a natural disaster, an unnatural disaster.
Yep.
I saw some stories yesterday about what's going on in Haiti, and I have to say it's just disturbing.
It is.
There's like this leader of Haiti called Barbecue. Okay. Have you heard about this? Wait a second. I took a screenshot of this yesterday.
That thug.
Listen to this. This guy's name is Barbecue. I kid you not.
Mm-hmm.
Haiti gang leader Jimmy Cherizier, who's also called Barbecue, said that if Haiti's prime minister, Ariel Henry, doesn't resign, Haiti will have a genocide. Barbecue went on. I'm sorry. You got to take this seriously. Barbecue went on to say that if the prime minister insists on staying in power, they can all expect a civil war. And there's cannibalism back on the menu.
Oh, my God.
Yes, fascinating.
Can you imagine being threatened by a person named Barbecue?
Just in case you hadn't anticipated this in 2024, we've already had so much to talk about. But now this guy called Barbecue, who is leading a gang of people who, among other things, are eating people. Great.
Yeah.
Haiti's just amazing. So democracy... Is it the best system? What did Churchill say? It's the best of the worst options. I'm paraphrasing.
I think that is the most apt description at this point because, wow.
All right. Well, let's welcome someone who actually knows what he's talking about here. He's not just speculating wildly like we are. Lukhona Mguni is a governance, politics, and development specialist. He's currently serving as the acting executive director and head of policy and research at Rivonia Circle. It's good to see you, Lukhona. How are you?
No, good. Good morning, Gareth.
Nice to see you again.
Good morning, guys.
Yeah.
No. I'm awake at least. It's one of those times.
No comments about barbecue in Haiti.
No. I mean, barbecue is a household spice, so you must respect barbecue.
Yes. You don't want any of that smoke.
Any home that loves its meat has barbecue.
Yeah, for sure. Need those herbs and spices, but this guy's a little bit too spicy.
Too spicy for your liking.
So, Lukhona, last time we had you on, we talked about a voter apathy.
Yeah.
And in the run-up to these elections now, we've got a record number of people registered. First of all, just to pick up on where we left off with you last time we had you on, how do you feel about that? Do you think that the registration drive has been a success? Are you feeling like there's a change in particularly young South Africans' point of view about the importance of elections?
Look, I mean, it's been a while since we last spoke, but I think two things are becoming quite evident for me. Is one, there is an appetite for change, but there's no momentum for change. Okay.
And people are just sitting.
So
people hungry, but they're not willing to get up.
Yeah, people would love to see change. I think they have not taken the belief that the vote is a mechanism that is truly available to them to effect the change. And that's where I see the lack of momentum for change. So are people going to go out in numbers and vote and, you know, reclaim democracy and assert their authority through the vote? That really stands to be seen. I'm still not convinced that, you know, we're going to have this super high turnout. I mean, of course, we've got over 27 million people on the voters' roll now, which is the highest number that has set since 1994. But if you look relative to the population size, we still have cohorts of the population that are extremely underregistered, like your 17 to 18, 19 to 25. Registration rates get better after 25. And I know that, I mean, just sorry, Gareth, yesterday when the IEC had its briefing at 6 p.m., and, you know, there was this, you know, breakdown of the voting numbers and the CEO of the IEC talking effectively to being impressed by, you know, the focus they've had on 18 to 39 year olds. But what is unfortunate about that is once you club the 18 to 39, you miss the story of the missing but still lower participation rates between 18 and 25.
All right, let me ask you this, because I don't know what else we have to do to get young people in this country to realize that this is their opportunity to purchase a piece of their own future.
You've got to give
them. It's like, come on, guys. I mean, we're leading the horse to water, and the water's great and the horse is thirsty, but it's still not drinking. Like, what's missing here?
I think we live in a society where young people don't have enough of a stake to actually, you know, view their participation. I must be careful how I phrase this. Where they don't view their participation in voting as directly impactful on them. And I keep saying my observation.
But I mean, how much do you need to do these people? I mean, they don't have jobs because of the economic conditions in the country, which is largely as a result of labor policies and lack of foreign investment and the job market that shrinks and the economy that is not growing. I don't know how else to make that clear. You go home and there's no electricity.
So, Gareth, when you talk to some people, you know, particularly on focus groups, it's quite interesting. It's this thing that Sizwe Mpofu-Walsh in his first book wrote about gradualism. And gradualism being that, you know, people await their turn. You believe that your turn is still coming. That, yes, I may be unemployed today, but I'm hopeful that my turn is coming. And I think once you start hitting your mid-20s, you start feeling the pressure of the state not delivering for you. Because remember, when you leave school, whether you leave high school after a trick, you think that there might be an opportunity to find work. You think that there might be an opportunity to further your studies and so on. And so you keep, there is a window of gradualism, so waiting your turn. And then that window starts closing and you realize, actually, you know what, I mean, gack. I need to think about things differently and do and start asking penetrating questions about the state. And I also think that young people, as they in their earlier stages where they are permitted to be voters, they've got other forms of expressing themselves and they've got other, you know, priorities that take up their time rather than, you know, electoral politics. Because let's face the truth, even those of us who have been voting at every turn that we have had,
we haven't
felt the material bearing of the power of our vote. And it's difficult to then convince others to, you know, yeah, sure, come vote, but they keep asking for what? Because one person said, you know, we're doing an event as the Rivonia Circle, and they said, I'm not sure if I said this last time, Gareth, but they said, you know, when I go to a furniture shop, I have a guarantee and warranty, but my vote has no guarantee or warranty. And I thought that was quite interesting from a young person.
You know, like I've spent a couple of days and weeks interviewing young people on the streets, like as part of one of our initiatives called VVIP. And it became alarmingly apparent to me that it's not necessarily that people don't want to vote just in J. It seems as if a lot of people actually understand just how much of a mammoth task it is to bring about some level of change, whether it be on a local level or on the macro level or the micro level. You understand? So is it the culture that has developed in this country, how much of a role does it play, do you think, in how people...
What part of the culture?
Like, what I mean is this, right? So a lot of South Africans don't need to be told what is wrong in the country, right? And when they think about how about going to fix that, it's a lot of people realize that it's a tall order.
Yeah, but you got to start somewhere.
Sure. Now, when we look at it in its totality, people look at things in their totality and they think to themselves, how is it possible that I could even bring about the smallest amount of change in the middle of all of this stuff?
Yeah.
And it seems to be a part of everyday culture that people look at things and think, no, there's no possible way that I can bring about change over there.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, there's that one, which is why I said there's an appetite for change, because that's mm-hmm. exactly what you are describing. But there's no momentum for change because people are also looking, where is this change going to come from?
Right.
And one of the things that has completely happened is that people have really lost trust in politicians.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter which t-shirt they're wearing. It's blue, red, yellow, green. Yeah. White, black, it doesn't matter.
Mm.
The politician has lost currency. And so one of the things that people say is, you know, you'll have a focus group with people for about 2 hours and they're harping on change. The country's going in the wrong direction. And then, but when presented with, you know, voting choices, it's like, no, I better stick with the devil that I know. Because the devil that I don't know, I am not sure what it's going to come to office and do. And of course, we know sometimes what the devils that we don't know do. They give us Kwamanda in the city of Johannesburg as so-called mayor. Really, there's no mayor in the city of Johannesburg. And they give us chaos in the city of Ekurhuleni, where they even start questioning, the auditor general, and the audit is not out, and you know, they get downgraded and they question that too, and so on. So, and these are now politicians from other parties and not the African National Congress per se. And people look around and they say, well, what reason do I have to trust that the other guys are going to do any better when they come to office?
So, we've got two things going on here. We've got that lack of trust in politicians, which I think is a very important part of this, and we have to take that seriously. And we'll look at that with respect to these candidate lists. I think that's interesting. I mean, is there anyone on those candidate lists just jumping out at you and screaming, leadership, leadership? Anyway, we'll look at that in a second. But the other thing is, and this is why I'm sorry to harp on this too, but okay, now we've given young people an opportunity to register. You said there's appetite, but no momentum. It's the same as like, these are the same people who have no momentum to do anything but go on social media and like scroll, 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 scroll. So we've got to just accept some of these people are just going to be left out until, as you put it, Lucona, that when they eventually get their shit together somewhere in the mid-20s, they're going to realize, it's time to take part.
Yeah.
So we've got to just wait for those people to get to the point where they are at that stage. Stop pandering to the 18-year-olds.
Yep.
They're not interested. There's no political parties, no leader in any political party who knows how to.
Mm-hmm.
So leave them behind. Don't worry about them. You don't see them in the queue on Voters Day? Too bad. We've tried.
Look, I mean, you never want to give up on anybody because, as they would say, there's no recycling bin for people.
Yeah.
But I think it is.
They'll get there one day.
No, absolutely, they'll get there. And some of them are there, right? Mm. Some of them are super active, highly active in student politics around the many campuses, you know, across the country, where, you know, they start getting involved. They form not just only political organizations to contest political power in the form of SRCs, but also independent, bodies. I mean, a number of some of the public voices we now have are actually born out of that student movement. I mean, I'd even think of somebody such as, you know, Mbuyiseni Ndlozi of the EFF. Mm-hmm. When we were at WITS, he was already in the SRC with the likes of Emmy Simba Lihlophe in Gauteng province. So there's a long history of a pipeline of young people who have come through the ranks of student politics and activism. So I think in that there is a good story to be told. The question is, how do you imagine it in volume? The only form, and again, I mean, because the vote is something that comes every 5 years, people are getting a bit frustrated with it. And I'll go back to this thing of a furniture shop having a guarantee and a vote not having a guarantee, is the sense that in between elections, how much power do I actually have as a voter? And I think that's another thing that we need to talk about, is what is it that we need to cultivate? And at the Rivonia Circle, we are constantly trying to think of innovative ways to continuously bring people closer to democracy in conversation with power, in conversation with democracy. Because if we don't do that, then of course we will lose the essence of the importance of democracy. It will almost be like a ritual, like going to church every Sunday. Right. But you've actually lost the connection of the essence of, you know, why you go to
it's
church.
It's like exercising the muscle.
So it's like that kind of. But look, I mean, yes, indeed, I often say to politicians when I advise them, because the politicians are always frustrated, how do we get young people to vote for us? I'm like, I'd spend less time and resources, to be quite honest, at the strategic level, trying to get the vote out from 20-year-olds and spend more time on people who previously voted but have become disaffected and are not willing to turn out, because there's a higher rate of possibly turning them out than people who are first-time voters.
Who benefits from less people coming to the polls?
The ANC.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned something just now, like you were talking about how, or at least you alluded to what it's basically the vote being the first step somewhat in how individuals interact with democracy moving forward. Yeah. Have we done a good or bad job in educating South Africans in mass as to how democracy actually works? Because I'm of the opinion that the first thing you do is vote. It's not the only thing. Like, there's a bunch of other things that you need to do after that. Like, your vote comes with a specific responsibility. Yeah. And I'm not sure, as South Africa from 94, I'm not sure if we've done a good enough job of educating one another about how democracy works.
Now, look, I think that's a fair point. In fact, you're reminding me. So over the weekend, I put up a tweet which actually traveled more than I thought it would. So I was asking people about their voting history, and I was sharing my voting history, and I was being called all sorts of things. I was being accused of infidelity with my vote, because I've voted for COPE, I've voted for the EFF, I've voted for Action SA, I've voted for the National Freedom Party in KZN in the 2011 local government elections, and I've voted for the UDM in the last national election. So, I mean, for me, in the first instance, is to plant in the heads of people that the vote can really be a mobile thing that you deploy strategically given where the conversation is during a particular election. And some people seem to take the view that what we should be celebrating is consistency of voting for the same political party. It's good for political parties to have loyalists, but it's probably even much better for the country to have loyalists who can change their vote when the political party is no longer, you know, acting properly, deploying the right people, as Gareth was talking about the list, you know, having the kind of policy focus that is responsive to the demands of the day. Mm. And thirdly, just giving a sense of believability that, you know, that organization will do that which it says it is committed to do. And I think before we even go beyond what happens between the vote is how strategic is this vote? And if you keep throwing it where you no longer have belief, you are no longer doing yourself service, and nor are you doing the country service.
You need to
be always open to the idea that you can change your vote. You can vote differently. I think that's the first important thing. Then, of course, in between elections, there are all the various instruments, but it's a bit of labor to interact with some of them. I mean, all of us have an opportunity to make comment on any law before it is passed. Sometimes we even end up in court about some of the laws, just like now we did in the Constitutional Court on the issue of signature requirements for underrepresented political parties. Because at times the establishment and incumbent parties try and legislate competition out and do self-preservation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a funny thing, because the assumption with this requirement for parties to show some level of support is that previous support of 5 years ago is still consistent and demonstrable. I can tell you now, there are political parties who would struggle, who are represented in parliament, who would struggle to get these signatures that are required of underrepresented parties in all provinces. And they only have to be represented to gain access to the ballot if they've paid the deposit and submitted their candidates. Right. But that's legislating competition out, because you can't tell me that the Congress of the People, which I've voted for before, that they are still as strong or stronger than Action SA.
They couldn't get 10,000 signatures.
We had an ample opportunity to interact with that legislative process, which we did. Some of us rallied society. But when the politicians legislate badly, then you have to go to court, which is even more expensive a task to do. And that's how, you know, countries get run badly, is because the politicians know it's not cheap money to go and challenge a piece of legislation in court. You know, lawyers are expensive and time is expensive. But I think we still have a long way to go in terms of educating people about democracy, about changes that are coming. One of the things that I'm exceedingly worried about in this upcoming election are the what I call the new introductions. So the signatures were one, and we didn't do enough to educate society to say, Gareth, don't be alarmed if a party asks you for your ID number and signature, because they really need that if they are going to be on the ballot. It doesn't mean you are voting for them, but you are giving them a chance to be on the ballot. Secondly, I'm sure you are aware now we will have three ballot papers, because we are going to be seeing independent candidates, you know, contest an election for the first time since 1994. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean in terms of the tiering of the three ballot papers? One is for the provincial legislature, two are for the National Assembly. The National Assembly seats have always been divided into two. 200 in what we call compensatory list, so that's proportional representation. Mm-hmm. 200 on a version of constituency based, which is not really constituency based, but it's another fight that we are still engaged with.
Yeah.
But it is to say the province is a constituency, and an independent candidate like Zaki Ahmad in the Western Cape will probably stand on that regional ballot for people to take him to parliament, but we'll be contesting against political parties. It's a whole schlep that we are still dealing with. But the last introduction, which I think is going to be even more exhausting for people, is that for the first time, the IEC is saying, if you are going to vote outside of your voting district, you must give notice to the IEC ahead of time. You remember in the past, you could literally, even if you are outside the province in which you are registered, still get access to the national ballot and vote nationally. Now, over 1 million people have been voting outside of their voting districts at every election since 1994. And I worry that some people might not get to hear this enough that, you know, and I think in the election timetable, it's the 17th of May. By the 17th of May, you must have notified the IEC where you will be on the 29th of May, which I think is a bit, it's a stretch too far to know exactly whether you will be
inside. Some people don't know where they're going to be tomorrow.
Some people's lives don't flow like that. People's lives don't flow like that.
You brought up something interesting just now. I mean, I remember when we had our first election and people didn't even want to say who they wanted to vote for.
Yeah.
Remember, it was your vote, your seat.
Yeah.
Luckily, I think we've got to a point, and I do think it's a part of the maturation of democracy, where people now will say, and I'm like you, embarrassed to admit that I voted for a lot of parties that have really let me down over the past. And at least I have a clear conscience that I shared that vote, and it wasn't a big deal to me.
Yeah. Mm.
What was a big deal is that the journey that came afterwards was that I had to admit that I was wrong to have trusted them with my vote. And we all learn these lessons.
Absolutely. Mm.
But this is the most interesting part of it now, not the registration or trying to get people to take part in the, you know, the preamble. Because now, and I saw Herman Mashaba on TV last night talking about actual policy things. Like he wants to get rid of the deputy ministers, which is, I think, something a lot of South Africans would say, yes,
yep,
absolutely. A lot of people go, well, they're being paid too much. So he said, we're going to cut their pay.
That's another
half.
One.
Another good one. Now we're starting to hear ideas, and we're starting to see, you know, policies from the EFF about open borders and how are we part of Africa or not part of Africa. Yeah. And these are conversations that we should be having.
Absolutely.
It's not just rhetoric about, you know, I don't like him because he once lied to me when we were in the ANC together. And I don't like him because he's going to these people and telling them behind my back. You know, you hear all this stuff. And actually, as you said earlier, we don't really care about politicians. We're not actually interested in them. We don't trust them. We don't like them. They just are what we have. So we must make the best of a bad bunch. So what do you think these candidate lists have to do with the elections, in terms of what people might, how it might change their minds when they see who the party prioritizes? Because we don't have a constituency-based system.
Yeah.
We have a party list system.
Absolutely.
And therefore, these lists are important because these are the people who will be put in charge if that party gets your vote.
No, certainly, Gareth. I mean, in the first instance, I think much of the politicking around elections, you're talking about manifestos, now candidate lists.
Yeah.
There's only just a minority of us who are going to scrutinize and interrogate some of those lists.
Yeah.
The majority of people will make their decision in terms of what they see, the look and feel, mm-hmm. how the party or leader makes them feel. And
personality
politics. I was trying to make somebody understand why, you know, there's a gravitation towards MK party. And this, you know, this interview, I was very frustrated with me because they don't like Jacob Zuma. I said, it's not about whether we like Jacob Zuma or not,
yes.
but we keep saying Jacob Zuma has charisma. He's a charismatic politician. Mm-hmm. So that must count for something. It's yep. an ingredient that not all people who get into politics have. And it works for you, whether you are good or bad. It
sure.
sustains you and gives you some mileage. Now, when you interrogate some of those lists, I mean, the leaked list, for example, from the ANC, which the ANC has now made its list public.
Both of us were confused about that, by the way. Has there ever been a requirement that these lists be hidden? Because surely...
No, but we're still in the window period where the IEC... So what the IEC does, the submission of the list, and then the IEC interrogates the list and then is able to go back to parties and say, you are non-compliant on these particular candidates. Please give us the requisite...
Because they're crooks, they're not allowed to actually run.
Please give us the requisite information. And then once that has happened, the lists are actually... published by the IEC for public scrutiny, and that will be on the 10th of April. So on the 10th of April, the public will have the opportunity to interrogate all the lists of parties that are now eligible to be on the ballot,
mm-hmm.
and there will be an opportunity for people to object to any of the names that may be on that list. For whatever reasons people may wish to object for, and then the IEC will look at the objections, assess them, and whether or not they pass. If the objection passes, the party will be notified and that candidate may be withdrawn from the list. But I think, I mean, it's one thing. So the lists that are always more exciting are ANC lists, because generally we know more of the ANC people.
No.
Than people from other parties. I mean,
I don't know any people on any of the party lists beyond like number 10.
Yeah.
Except the ANC.
Well, except the ANC list. I mean, that's why I keep saying to people, I mean, the ANC is a very difficult, beast to tackle, if we are to be honest, because the ANC can have parallel events in 30 different communities, because in actual fact, they have easily 30 people that they can deploy to any community who are known in that community, whether they are liked or not, or they are
sure.
thrown with tomatoes or not. That's different. But people will come.
Yeah,
they'll come to see Naledi Pando. They'll come to see Gwede Mantashe. They'll come to see Manusi Kikaba. They'll come, whatever you mention it. But I mean, I think what is interesting, I mean, this time around, particularly with the ANC list, if we just stick there for a second, is that there is an interesting, you know, return of some people. Clearly, they are still rooted within the organization. They are seen as, leaders in their own rights. The likes of Malusi Gigaba featuring quite highly.
Yeah, he came back in. Dr.
Zweli Mkhize is featuring quite high in the ANC list. But I think what is interesting for me is how talent is eroding in the provinces. I was actually looking at the Free State provincial list. After Mpolisi Dukwana, it's tickets, in that Free State province list, and it's a very serious province of vulnerability for the ANC. But mm-hmm. I mean, if you think of politicians who've come and gone from the Free State, there seems to be a waning talent pool in terms of who the ANC is deploying. So I'm watching provinces quite interestingly. I mean, people like Action SA, Hemen Mashaba yesterday introduced a Team Fix SA, but some people don't even know the people there. But I mean, he's got the former CEO of the Health Professionals Council of South Africa, Dr. Khoshili Lape. I think Solly Mueng was also introduced, a strong voice in civil society. But people don't know those people. Only us
Did you know. See anybody interesting on the MK lists? Because...
Well, Des Van Rooyen and Weekend Special.
I
thought that was interesting.
Jack asked the question. So Jacob Zuma can't be president, according to that list. But who else is on there that that is high up. I didn't recognize any names.
Mm-hmm. No. I mean, in the top 10, I mean, Des van Rooyen, by virtue of being former minister, I mean, he was Minister of Finance for 3 days over the weekend.
Yeah.
Following the removal of Tanzania, which we protested, many of us protested that appointment. Yeah. And then, of course, Jacob Zuma's daughter, Duduzile, is featuring quite highly.
Number 8.
On that MK list. And I think that's interesting signaling in terms of her wanting to play a role. And if you believe we need to interrogate beyond the top 10 in the MK list, because the Brandhurst Foundation study that has come out placing MK at 13% nationally effectively means that MK could potentially deploy 40 to 45 members of parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do very well in provinces like KZN, where we know that they'll need a separate list. Absolutely. Also need your provincial leadership.
Absolutely. And their leadership that's potentially going to be in government, because there seems to be, at least mathematically, there is no coalition that emerges without MK.
So let's stick to the MK and the ANC for a second, because the ANC's list you mentioned already, interesting things there that they, also a lot of the old people are leaving.
Yeah.
So you've got your, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, who's out now. Yeah. She's decided she's retiring. Pravin's out. Naledi Pandor's out. Some of these people who've been around a long time. And they've brought in new names. Some of these names are a little bit more well-known than others. Some have been in cabinet, for example, deputy ministries, that sort of thing. The EFF's lists have not changed. They've hardly changed at all. Certainly the top 10 in there. You know, you've got number 1, Julius, number 2, Floyd, number 3, Dalimpofu.
Mm-hmm.
Number 4, Godrich Gadi, I think. Number 5, Buiseni. Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
They're all more or less the same.
No, we'll have to see with the...
10 years, nothing's changed.
We will have to see. I mean,
thankfully they were young enough when they started all of this, so they don't necessarily have to change.
They're not dead yet.
They still feel young, by the way.
They still feel young, yeah.
But I think something interesting, I mean, look, the EFF list is still under seal at the moment, at least this one. I look forward to it coming out, because I do think that there are some interesting dynamics within the EFF itself. I mean, in terms of just how sometimes public representatives of that party are mistreated, because
we saw this just last week.
There's just a heavy hand.
It's
called accountability, but I don't believe that it's the kind of version of accountability that you need. Mm. So over the past 5 years, the EFF has effectively let go of some MPs over the FNB Stadium bus issue.
Mm-hmm.
There was, the EFF has always tried to really act speedily on some people, and I think they might well try and bring in some freshness of new talent, but we must also be mindful that there are also internal battles currently underway in the EFF. There's always this under the surface kind of maneuver between the president and the deputy president of the EFF, and it plays sometimes itself out in this jostling for the top spots in the list. So people like Dalimpofu, who is no longer in the leadership of the EFF and probably has no appetite to go to parliament anyway, will probably not feature. What will be interesting is to see where the current MPs are ranked. Are they within, what we call an electable position? And an electable position is by virtue of a prediction of how much, a party is going to secure at the polls.
Mm-hmm.
And how many newer names are coming up. It will also be interesting to see who they choose to deploy for the Gauteng legislature, where they have communicated Mbuyiseni Ndlozi as their premier candidate.
Mm-hmm.
In Gauteng. What team will they be putting behind Mbuyiseni Ndlozi for Gauteng? Because Gauteng is no longer a question of probabilities. Gauteng will be led by a coalition government, and that coalition government could feature the EFF. And so it will be an interesting signaling to the residents of Gauteng to say, this is who the EFF believes can actually go into government in Gauteng.
Looking at the some of those lists, do you see any indication that there's certain parties that are more willing to lend themselves to coalition or... When you look at those lists, are there some that make you think, okay, by virtue of this person being so high up on the list, it doesn't seem as if a coalition could actually materialize?
No, sure. I mean, parties go to elections to win it, at least the bigger parties. But the more discerning parties know where to box. They probably, whilst they are thinking of possibilities of coalition, so they need to put some of their strongest people forward, particularly in Gauteng, in KwaZulu-Natal, possibly in the Western Cape, even though some people are still in denial about this. And then we probably have a wild card province where, like I said earlier, in the Free State, the ANC is quite vulnerable, and you start seeing the vulnerability.
Who are they vulnerable to?
They're vulnerable to, a mix of opposition. I think Ace Magashule is also an interesting one. If you looked at the poll that was released by Ipsos about a month ago, after ACT was featuring in that poll at about 1.5%, that 1.5% is probably most likely to come from the Free State itself. And of course, a mix of other opposition parties. And you see this in the composition of the Mangaung Metro. So, I mean, the ANC first starts being weak in the metros before it then becomes weak at a provincial level. So in the Mangaung Metro, they just made it, and they always need everybody to be alive and present at council. Otherwise, they lose the mayorship vote, which is how they lost the mayorship vote. And they went to court over that sitting, and then it was overturned. But the point is it indicates the vulnerability they have. So they can no longer arrogantly just be absent from, you know, have some members being absent from council and think that they'll get everything passed. So the Free State is interesting for me at the back of my head in terms of looking there, because there's a mix of emerging small, you know, community-based organizations and other parties that are very localized to the Free State and so on, of some personalities somewhere within the ANC universe, others were not. So I think they are vulnerable to a number of opposition parties. But again, when you look at the list, are people signaling that there will be a coalition? Some, I think, are mindful of that. They don't want to be caught flat-footed. Because a coalition government can be an opportunity for you to showcase, to grow, to expand.
I just want to quickly remind everybody who's joining us for the first time this morning that you can comment, and we will often put the comments to our guest. Today, Lukona's happy to answer some of your questions. So if you've got something you want to ask him about the elections, you're welcome to do so. I also wanted to ask you this situation that we see in the news now. And I saw a bunch of people getting very hot under the collar about election observers. This is like a nothing burger, because election observers come from all over the world to any country that allows them in. We're one of those countries that says, whomsoever wants to come, let him come. Come and see. The IEC are very confident that they've got a free and fair election planned. They have been here in the studio with us. I was mightily impressed by them, I have to say. I think that they've got a very competent crew of people over there who are trying their best to make sure that every foreseeable obstacle is removed, and that we have the best possible turnout, the best possible election day, and the best possible accounting of the results. However, you are allowed to bring in election observers. Why is it so many people are getting really angry on Twitter, and why are the government upset about the idea that we could have election observers?
No, I don't think it's about the concept of election observers. I mean, the IEC system is open now for people to apply to be election observers until about next week, if I'm not mistaken, or early May, actually. I think here it's a political contestation. It's not about the observers. It's about the author of the letter,
Which is John Steenhuisen and the DA,
which is probably was probably a little tactless of the DA, because whilst they want to actually, you know, appear as caring enough about the elections and observers, then one might ask, why didn't you write to the African Union to send election observers?
Who in the whole universe is taking the African Union
exactly,
seriously?
You see,
Earth is taking the African Union seriously?
But I mean, you write to Antony Blinken in the US, and
who's taking him seriously?
It makes a political statement, because he too does probably not deserve to be taken seriously. He's also just facing an election to fight and fight off Trump now. In the Biden campaign. So I think, Gareth, the issue is not about the observers. The issue is about the political tact. And you'll remember the DA has done a number of these now. They wrote to the FBI after the Palapala issue and the Ramadollars. and I think it's just that sense of appearing to be why are you always signaling to one side of the universe?
Yeah.
And then, of course, I mean, they had another fight with the national government, if you remember, when Alan Winde took a delegation from the Western Cape to the U.S. to meet some Congress people because they wanted to create a,
didn't they also a case for South Africa's viability as well.
To remain in AGOA. Of course, yeah. John went there to peep through some stuff in Ukraine.
I mean, it's just, it's very, it's someone, so it's someone, about, so it's someone
about,
in there.
So it's really about the DA politics rather than that. And in any event, when you ask for observers, they often, more than anything, come outside of government structures. So you can't write to a government, you know, for observers to come. They often come from, you know, retired presidents, you know, civil society, and all of these multilateral bodies. But once you signal to a government, and then some people are saying, but you are inviting the US to come meddle, as if it doesn't meddle anyway.
So, you know, on the topic of the DA, they are part of this multi-party charter, this moonshot pact. By your estimation, how much of an impact will this pact have? And is it fool's gold or what's happening there? Was there a point to all of this? Because to some of us from the outside looking in, it seems as if the DA being the elephant in the room, sort of, just is trying to position themselves with everyone else just to put this thing together. That way they put themselves in a position whereby one of their core members within the DA is then put into strategic positions that they kind of take over the country.
No, sure. I mean, look, I think there was a sense of being genuine. Of course, politics, there's always the politics, but let's start with the genuine part. South Africans are becoming worn out by the fragmentation of the political landscape. Mm-hmm. Too many political parties, too many political players. It seems as if everybody has an ego, can't cooperate, can't work together, and. So that frustrates South Africans quite materially. So then what do you do? There has to be some form of consolidation that takes place. However, a pre-election consolidation has its own political limitations because how the DA positioned itself when John Steenhuisen made this call for a moonshot pact last year, April, when he was giving his closing remarks at the DA Congress after having been elected, re-elected leader of the DA. What he effectively did was to put the DA at the center and said, everybody's coalescing around the DA, which is why the name was contested, for example, in terms of the moonshot pact, which is why when they then went to at the Emperor's Palace, where they negotiated what eventually became the charter of the multi-party charter of South Africa. And if you read the charter quite extensively, it also demonstrates that the people in the room were also wary of the DA not using this as a proxy to just consolidate power for its own self, which is why there is a clause in the charter that says, the party with the largest share of the votes is not guaranteed that it will automatically, you know, occupy the seat of president. And already, if you remember back then, the Sunday Times had led with a huge spread of an interview with Peter Groenewald of the FF Plus, who said that South Africa is not ready for a white president and that he would go into those conversations backing the IFP president, Velenkosini Hlabisa, to become the face of the multi-party charter. There's still no agreement on those things. So whilst we know what parties are giving us, but we are not seeing an emerging multi-party charter list, and we're probably not going to see it. And I think this is the weakness of the multi-party charter. Its weakness is that whilst we are saying we are working together, we are still all on the same ballot, and we want you to make a choice among one of us. And what I think is emerging, if you look at how Action SA is losing momentum in the polls, is that the multi-party charter is probably beginning to hurt them because the Action SA was eating in terms of, you know, DA territory, if you look at the 2021 local government elections. But why should I stop voting for the DA and then vote for Action SA if my vote anyway is guaranteed to be prioritized in a mix of the DA? That's the first instance. And I think that there's weakness there. There's also weakness in that the multi-party charter does not logically work across all provinces. So, for example, in KZN, the multi-party charter is fairly strengthened because the DA is fairly large and the IFP is growing, or at least MK now is starting.
That's where it'll be the most useful.
That is where it will be most useful. But in Gauteng, for example, where the IFP is really a very small player, they have one seat in the legislature, highly unlikely that, you know, the DA will cross the line, only on the multi-party charter universe. They have to think carefully about what they now say about the EFF. I mean, if you think back how John Steenhuisen last year, April, declared the EFF political enemy number one. But when he was launching his manifesto, he made no mention of the EFF. So he has toned down, I think, and he's being advised that anyway, be careful because you don't know where you're going to land up in terms of the arrangements, because the mathematics of the multi-party charter does not work across all provinces. And in any case, I mean, I think South Africans also just don't like, while they like robust politics, they don't like this politics that seems to divide people and pit them against one another. Because once you say the DA is political enemy, I mean, the EFF is political enemy number one, then you're also encouraging your supporters to view EFF voters as enemies. And some people stay in the same households and they vote, one votes the DA, one votes the EFF. And because the DA has, in actual fact, support in areas where the EFF also has support in communities like Tembisa, in the northern townships of the city of Tswane, as an example, and so on. So the point really is that I think the multi-party charter is an interesting phenomenon, but I think it has significant political limitations because it demonstrates how difficult consolidating our political landscape is. Because if the multi-party charter was sitting on the ballot as one umbrella party, that would be interesting. That would be game changing. But now there's nothing significant.
It's like they're all keeping their options open.
Keep our lines open to one another. And I think, you know, with introduction of, and when the MPC was there, there was no imagination of MK. And I think MK is a really significant entrant and disruptor. Because now you have to make difficult choices. In KZN, for example. So what is the priority? Is it to keep the ANC out? Irrespective of who you do it with, or is it to keep the ANC in so that you keep MK out? Which one is now a better devil?
So this is interesting because Azalea says in the comments, so basically the ANC is going to win. That's not what you're saying.
No. That's not what I'm saying.
In fact, their overall share of the vote has dropped. But the interesting thing is, who are they going to have to be friends
Absolutely.
With? And who are all the other parties going to have to be friends with if they want things? And I say friends, I mean coalition. Who are they going to have to need to rely on in order to make these coalitions work? And actually, someone said to me the other day, we are such a diverse country. It makes perfect sense that we would have to have coalition governments.
Yeah.
Because we're constantly having to negotiate, you know, these different elements in society, different language groups, different ethnic groups, different levels of wealth or poverty, different levels of age. There are all kinds of things going on. So we need a government that is made up of all these different smaller groups. But do you think that there are going to be any big surprises? I mean, we see a lot of these polls coming out now. We spoke about the Brenthurst one just this week because that's big news. And some people are very angry about this.
Floyd Pibambu
says it's bullshit. He's not even paying attention to it, right? Are you expecting any surprises? Is there any kind of, because you also do these focus groups, you speak to lots of people and you're trying to get a handle on the future. Anything that you're really concerned about and or excited about?
I think I'm excited about the possibility of a national coalition government, whichever way it swings, because I think it will be the first step towards, you know, the dominance of the ANC defining politics in South Africa starting to wane. If you look at how politics is done in South Africa, it doesn't matter whether you're the DA or the EFF and so on. The standard is the ANC. The way in which you do elections, the way in which you do campaigns, everybody now wants to occupy a stadium. Everybody has mad amounts of posters all over the country. Everybody has there's almost like a list of things that the ANC has defined in terms of how to do politics. And it's become a very expensive exercise to actually compete on that scale with the ANC.
It is interesting that IFP, ANC, and EFF all had their rallies in Moses Mabhida.
Because that's the battleground. That's the battleground.
That's where it's going down.
Gauteng is a given that it will be a coalition government. KZN, not so much. And it is a battleground, because even the introduction of MK Party, if you look at the by-elections that the MK Party has contested in, it's clear that it has taken take support from the ANC, from the IFP, from the EFF. So it's important for those parties to also be in KZN to reassure their constituencies that they're still dominant, they're still able. I mean, I think for the IFP, it was probably the first time they've tried to fill up such a big stadium. I mean, they've always taken, you know, like Chatsworth Stadium.
They did okay.
In Durban. And I was impressed, I must say. I was very impressed at how I was doubtful if they would be able to fill up Mabida. But it's, again, that demonstration of strength, of force. Reassure your voters, reassure your party members, let them go out there and communicate with society and campaign, you know, with a sense of vigor. So I think
by the way, Tabisa, he talked for hours. It felt like hours.
Well, it's probably still shorter than Prince Mangos bless his soul. But the point is, I'm excited about the possibility, of a coalition government nationally, because even if it's still the ANC in power, but them needing another player to remain in power will create an interesting dynamic and conversation. And I think it will open up the 2029 elections to be even much more interesting and so on. I am worried, of course, about what that means, because remember, now we're in 2024. And soon enough, we will be transitioning to talk about the local government elections in 2026. Whether they'll be in 2026 or early 2027, it will depend on the president and the IEC's conversations about that. But the 2026 local government elections are probably then even going to be more worrisome for people. And depending on what will be happening at the time with whatever coalition governments in the provinces and in national, it may make voters lose appetite for coalition politics. Right. Whilst inherently our society is as diverse as Gareth is saying, but the voter has a problem to accept coalitions, because sometimes they're noisy, they look chaotic, there's bickering rather than centering the citizens and so on. And in that sense, some people might then retreat to not take chances with newer political parties, not take chances with smaller political parties, but actually want to go back to what they may deem parties that have a chance to win. And that would be retreating back to establishment parties like the ANC, the DA, and of course now the EFF is probably in its third election becoming an establishment party too.
Interesting times. And it was brought to our attention a couple of weeks ago that, you know, South Africa, historically speaking, we've kind of dealt with one party at a time. Like, so during apartheid, of course, it was the National Party. Ever since 1994, we've only had to deal with the ANC. So moving forward, we're going to have to muddle our way through it and try to figure it out. But I think the public's participation after the vote is what I've got my eyes, I'm keenly watching there, because there's going to be a lot of upheaval in certain corners of this country, whether we like it or not. Violence has never been devoid in our politics in this country. We know of ward councillors being killed and all a whole host of other really horrible things. So, yeah, man, I like you. You've given me certainly quite a bit to think about, because you brought up a couple of things that actually did not cross my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think also, I mean, it depends where you are. So if you're in Gauteng, yes, that is the concern. But if you're in KZN, where you've seen, IFP lead from 1994, right about 2004, in coalition with the ANC, 2004, Sbundebele takes over, again, in coalition with the IFP. And then in 2006, November, that coalition breaks down. And the ANC then goes in coalition with the UDM and the Minority Front to 2009. And in 2009, the ANC becomes an outright majority winner in KZN. So KZN has always been a sort of an interesting story of success for democracy for me. Whilst we always talk about the political violence and so on, but power has changed hands so many times in KZN. I mean, who will forget Zanele Magwaza Gamsibi, the late in 2011, coming with the National Freedom Party. And that led to almost 19 or 20 hung councils that forced the NFP into a coalition with the ANC. So people of KZN have seen this, and I think they're not nervous in actual fact about it. And that's why when you talk to people in KZN, they're most likely to split their votes nationally and provincially, because they've seen they hedge their bets differently. You go to the Western Cape. I mean, at some point, Helen Zille was holding on to the mayorship in the city of Cape Town with one vote. Or something ridiculous like that. The Western Cape government itself, I mean, the likes of Ibrahim Rasool, Lynn Brown, have led that province on behalf of the ANC, and power has changed hands to the DA. And so it's some provinces have just not been in it in this democracy story and seeing power change hands, but some provinces actually have, and yeah. They've been fine. And I think that people of Gauteng should not be scared. They will be fine.
Well, that's all we got time for this morning. It's always great to have you in here, Lukwana. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great insights. And I think there's some valuable, useful information you could put into your overall impression of what may or may not happen. But definitely, certainly some clear answers for you also on things that otherwise just get bandied about in the Twitter universe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And most of that's just terrible, terrible.
I always say Twitter is a space, yes, not a place. So take it with a pinch of salt.
And let's not forget that when we talk about space, most of space is a vacuum. How's the PhD going?
Oh, I'm on a break, I must say. Too much work around the elections. After these elections, I'll go back. I just have to write it up. I've done the research. I've transcribed. I just have to sit down for about 6 months, write it, and then get over with it. But I think the work that we've been doing around the elections, playing our small role to try and safeguard the democracy space, has been much more important to me.
And let's just be clear, the Rivonia Circle is very different to Rise Mzanzi, which
absolutely
is now Songezo's political party.
That's the political party. Right. Rivonia Circle remains a political think tank, and we are growing our footprint in terms of partnerships. We are doing some work with the Danish Embassy on coalition governments, actually. Mm-hmm. We are doing some work with Constitutionalism Fund. We are doing some work even with other, role players in the political space. We are still being asked to come moderate, facilitate, and all of this.
Are you taking American money to destabilize everything?
Yeah, taking some money from foreign governments. You've got to get money from somewhere. No. I mean, I think we try our level best to make sure that we apply for grants to institutions that are aligned with our work, that can support our work. There'll always be criticism, but it's always easier for people who want to. There are people who want to be professional critics, and always fall fine with those who are trying to get some solutions to the problems that we confront as a country. I'm happy with the work that we do. And I don't, some people will always say, it's like you sleep and wake up with a phone call from George Soros every morning telling you what to do, remote controlling your thinking. And sometimes—
Is he a funder?
Not him. Society? Open Society Foundation, we've definitely gotten some good grants from them. And he's
coming under some heavy fire in Haiti at the moment.
No, of course. I mean, for good reason, he takes it's like, but the truth is that there is no one who tells us what to do. In fact, I get sad sometimes when I see stuff on social media, because one of the things we have not seen is institutions that are, built from scratch, particularly by Black people in spaces where, Black people have not really played a meaningful role in building institutions. I mean, we are beating up now with well-established institutions. The Rivonia Circle is only 2 years old, mm-hmm. and we are committed to build it into the future. And I think that's the story that gets to be untold when we focus on these things about who your funders are and so on. The story that actually here are people who are building an institution from scratch and introducing some innovative ways of how to do democracy. And our colleagues get invited internationally to various forums. My colleague Tessa Dooms, your Londi Remlam, and others. They go on regional conferences, international conferences. We are resource people. We are speakers. We are talking now. The World Global Assembly on Democracy is coming to South Africa later this year, and we're in conversation with the Secretariat for that to assist and so on. So we are doing well. I'm happy with where we are, and we are really committed, Gareth, to build a political think tank. Of course, there has been that journey of Beth towards Rise Mzansi. And Rise Mzansi has a life.
And there's some very interesting candidates in Rise Mzansi who are getting quite a lot of attention at the moment.
Yeah.
Good attention. All right. Lucano, we're going to let you get back to your hard work and your PhD, among other things. And very good to have you here this morning.
No. Always a pleasure.
Lucano Mboni and Jack Mutlante and Gareth Cliff, thank you. That's all we got time for this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. That's Democracy 101. We will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Cheers.